worry, no sweets. Only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel.
Hey everyone, welcome to Vegan Warrior Princesses Attack.
And the Bearded Vegans.
I'm Nicole.
And I'm Callie.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Paul.
And today we'll be talking about
the presidential election and how to be a vegan activist in the era of the Orange Menace.
Ooh.
Ooh.
I just really hate saying his name, so I just every time try to find a different way of saying it.
I respect that. Yeah. But first, Andy's got some news.
Okay, so we have been trying to be a timely podcast, but Paul and myself, we record a week in advance, so we're not very timely. And I figured
we're very efficient, though.
We are efficient. I figured we might as well take that to its logical extreme and talk about a video that came out a year ago. And this thing came across my dash, and I was like, this is horrible. And I sent it to you two. And Nicole, you're like, I actually saw that and wrote a whole article on it. So I don't know if this is really news because it involves PETA doing some bullshit. But this video came across my dash, and I was like, oh, this is horrible. I need to talk about it with someone. And it's a video involving with PETA basically saying that in order to be a better lover in bed, you need to go vegan. And I saw this and I was like, this needs to go to Callie and Nicole right away. And of course, Nicole, you're like, actually, this has been out for a while. And I already wrote an extensive article on it. So I didn't want to toss it to you and give us your thoughts on this video. We will, of course, link to this video in our show notes so everyone can watch it in its entirety.
Yes. And we will as well, even though I hate giving them traffic. Yeah, so this video essentially shows side-by-side scenes, one of a carnivore couple having sex and one of a vegan couple having sex, and basically shows that the carnivore guy, it's unclear if he comes too quickly or if he can't keep it up, but in either case, he disappoints his lover and ends up getting squished by an air conditioner.
Spoiler alert!
Everyone does.
Well, I gotta talk about it.
I mean, not right away he gets squished.
No, after, if he doesn't finish.
Immediately.
After his
squished. Yeah, just immediately.
Yes. After his angry lover kicks him out because he can't satisfy her. And then, of course, in the right-hand side, the vegan couple's just boning down the entire time that this is going on.
You just had to get that phrase in, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. We're going to take it to Bone Town today. Callie's just disgusting. Yeah. Alrighty. So there's so many issues with this video. You know, first of all, everyone looks like a supermodel, so it's just annoying that PETA continues to insist that only people who match conventional beauty standards are people worth watching having sex. It would be nice to see, you know, other races and body types and sexualities represented. It's very heteronormative. It's very, like, cis normative. I don't know if that's a word, but you get my drift.
It is now.
It is now. So that, you know, that in and of itself is a whole problem, that this lens of sexuality from PETA is always presented in this really mainstream, you know, single view. And then for me, the thing that pissed me off the most was that the way it's filmed, it's very much reinforcing the idea that sex and, like, sexual satisfaction is all the man's responsibility. And again, keep in mind that this is very, like, cis-normative, so that's how I'm going to talk about it. But, you know, you're seeing, like, even in the vegan couple who's having this amazing sex, it's focused on the woman's face. You never even see the guy's face. So he's just there being this agent of, like, giving the great D, and the woman is, like, just receiving it. Like, she's not doing anything besides taking it, right? And I just, mm-hmm. I just hate, it's like this toxic masculinity perpetuation of guys have to, like, fuck really well and stay hard forever and, like, do all these things to keep a woman satisfied, and it just makes sex seem like a very one-sided thing. Like, women are just objects, like, we're just there to look good and inspire these feelings of sexuality in the man, and then the man's there to, like, have to be this performer to keep us happy. And then that's what we see with the carnivore couple, too, is that the guy is the one who can't perform, And so he's failed his duty as a man and gets kicked out and for some reason also killed by an air conditioner. I mean, it's like really fucked up. Like when I saw that ending, I was like, that was really fucked up.
Yeah.
Like you can't please someone so you're going to die. It's just so bizarre.
Is the idea that the vegan couple was having such intense sex that it knocked the air conditioner out? That's what I thought it was. Is that what you thought?
I mean, I don't think that was.
I don't know if it was like his girlfriend pushed the air conditioner on top of him. Or,
I wondered that as well.
Yeah, I was like, whatever this is, it's just way too violent. It doesn't make any sense. Anyway. So that also was, you know, a really frustrating thing. And then I also have a big problem with the fact that sex in our society is represented as, like, penis and vagina. They could have shown the guy, like, going down on her and then pulling out some toys. There's, like, so many different ways to have sex. And again, it just goes back to this heteronormative script that we have that everyone must like to have sex the same way, and that's not true at all.
And for the same length of time.
Right.
Sometimes also, sex that goes on forever isn't fun.
Thank you. Thank you. Not every time you want to have this like wild 2-hour session. Sometimes you want to like get back to Netflix binging. Yeah, you just want to go to sleep or whatever. So yeah, that's another thing. It's PETA yet again perpetuating basically the porn narrative, like mainstream porn narrative of sex and sexuality. It's just really harmful. They're just perpetuating a lot of harmful shit in order to get people to go vegan, which it doesn't make any sense, really. I mean, we talk about it all the time, but if you get someone to go vegan under those circumstances, their veganism is always going to be really shaky. You're not going to get a hardcore ethical vegan out of something like that. You're just not. And you know, I'm really sensitive to, I guess it goes back to toxic masculinity, but I really hate how much I see in the public narrative about shaming men for, you know, not having giant penises or not being able to be hard for a really long time. It really affects men's security, you know, like feelings of insecurity. And I just think it's really shitty. It's a shitty thing that we put on men. And this ad is pretty much that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's shaming you if you're not a certain way. And that's really sucks. It really sucks. Like I've noted it in like people that I've dated that it really does affect people pretty deeply, that there's these expectations and that they should be ashamed if they can't meet them. And I just don't want my veganism being used as a way to reinforce stuff like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. The video, when I watched it, it reminded me a lot of this great talk by Jenny Bundock called The Hidden Cost of Patriarchy. Have you two seen that video by any chance?
I don't think I have.
It's great.
Is she like a blonde? She looks like she's kind of in like a classroom type setting. Yes. We have seen it. She's the one that she's like, this talk is going to make you uncomfortable. Like if you're male, you basically need to like be quiet and take it.
Yeah.
I mean, not exactly those words, but
that doesn't sound very consent culture.
No.
Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. But she has like a whole section on, you know, if we're just using this quote unquote tits told me to go vegan strategy, it's no surprise that we're attracting so many predatory men into the movement. Like if people are, if these, you know, cisgender men are just coming in like, yeah, I want to fuck for a long time. I got to get 300 thrusts in or else I'm not a man. That kind of like attitude. It's like that we're not attracting the best people into the movement. And it's like, yeah, we want a vegan world. We want everyone to go vegan, but those don't need to be the first people that get brought into the fold. And that's going to affect the movement overall. And that's going to drive a lot of, you know, women out of the movement.
That's a great point.
It is a great point. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. I just hate that PETA continuously, not only do they perpetuate so many different forms of oppression in their advertising, but they're constantly making false promises to people. Mm-hmm. Like that is not going to help anyone go or stay vegan. You know, you're not immediately going to be like this thin, blonde, like beautiful supermodel the minute you go vegan. You're not instantly going to be able to perform differently in bed just by going vegan. It's like, stop making all these fucking promises.
Exactly. Damn it, PETA.
God, I fucking hate them so much. Like, the level that I hate them is just off the charts.
Yeah. I can't believe I have so much, like, ire for an organization.
Right.
Ugh.
It feels good to get it out, though.
It does.
I feel like we haven't talked about PETA in a hot minute on the show.
I know.
So much so that we had to bring up something that was a year ago published to talk about this.
Well, that's kind of the way things work online, right? Things kind of go, and you don't always necessarily know that they're out there, and then you find it, and it's like, what the heck? Because things can get, like, brought back up again and then start going around Facebook or social media, yeah. And it seems like it's a new thing, but it's just kind of being...
And I do like this one because I feel like this one is PETA to its core.
Yes.
Like, this is all of PETA's tactics, you know, the major ones they use in, like, one ad... And so it's a really good one to talk about because it just shows, you know, so much of what is a problem with PETA that a lot of people, at least at first, don't understand is so harmful. So I think it's a good thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's a good conversation starter about why they're the literal worst.
and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is not the first of this type of ad that PETA has done specifically for the Super Bowl.
Oh, they had that ad that was like, blow your partner's like lower half out, basically.
Oh, no, I wasn't even thinking about that.
Knock your bottom out.
Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah. You mean the one where the woman got fucked so hard that she was like in a neck brace and wobbling down the street? Yeah, that was a good one, too. Let's just reinforce like domestic violence and porn.
Yeah.
Isn't there also one where it's just like a bunch of women like humping vegetables, too?
Yes, they had a porn casting calls where the women used vegetables for their sexual auditions.
My eyes are rolling so hard they're going to get like stuck up in my head. Like it's just yeah, they also, for those who may not know or haven't listened to our old episode, they actually had a porn website. Like they ran a porn site of actual porn that they had spliced in factory farm...
slaughterhouse footage.
Yeah, slaughterhouse footage into the middle of the porn. So it's like you're watching people have sex and it's all some like, slaughterhouse. Yeah. Like they have so a long history. Yeah, they have a long history of mixing like sex and violence.
Which, by the way, is literally how you create serial killers. I'm not kidding.
That's the formula?
Yes. When you have someone who's reaching like their like sexual maturity, and if they get a blend of like sexual stuff with violent stuff, it can fuck them up. And PETA's like creating that and putting it out there.
It's their master plan, just create a bunch of serial killers.
Probably.
Yeah.
So yeah, PETA sucks.
Yeah.
End of story. And that video is just the worst.
I just feel so bad for the people that work at PETA.
I know.
And try to make a difference because, you know, I know we say it every time, but there are a lot of good people that actually work at PETA and do really good work. And it just sucks that there's one group of PETA people. I mean, and I think it's coming directly from the top, too, that are fucking ruining it for everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew a lot of the touring crews that went around, and you know, it's kind of, if you brought up PETA, it's always kind of like a shrug and like, yeah, I know, but it's like one of the few paying jobs I can get in animal advocacy, so I'm just kind of doing this, and you know, I'm just showing people footage of what happens and educating about veganism. I don't have to do with that other stuff. And yeah, I feel like I felt horrible because when I was touring with Farm, people would be like, are you PETA? And be like, no, they're like, okay, you're cool. Like, just like immediately people are really upset and just want to attack PETA people. So I feel bad for the sort of the underlings that aren't really in charge of those decision-making processes.
Yeah. And I mean, to have the platform that they do and the amount of funding that they get, it just sucks to see how they continue to perpetuate such bad and harmful shit within the vegan movement and to the general public.
Yeah.
Yep.
Some bullshit.
It is bullshit.
I think that's all we have to say on the matter.
Yep.
I mean, I could go on about it for hours, but I already did in episode 14. So if you like hearing Nicole rant about PETA, we made an entire episode about it.
It was really eye-opening.
Yeah.
Are you at 10 for the whole thing?
Oh my gosh. I'm on 10 for the rest of the day.
I just love that there's this idea that you're like not at 10 sometimes.
Sometimes I'm a 9.5. Yeah. Like when I first wake up. So, yes, moving on.
Yes. So,
we have a sad news story today.
Yes, unfortunately, we do. Reported by Veg News, although the story has been everywhere, I feel like. Tilikum dies at SeaWorld. So a very sad story. SeaWorld announced the death of the beloved 35-year-old captive whale days before the final orca show at the park's San Diego location. So Tilikum was a huge part of the documentary Blackfish, kind of like the star, and I think one of the driving forces behind the story and why it captured so many people's attention, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I have not seen Blackfish.
Paul confessed to me he has not actually seen Blackfish.
Well,
I mean, I'm not going to
blasphemy.
I'm not going to SeaWorld anyways. I don't need to. No, I probably should, but I just haven't.
And now you
it's
never
a,
will.
It's a really good documentary.
Yeah, it is.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not a big fan of a lot of documentaries, but that's one that I liked. Because it had a lot of really good information, but it wasn't just like torture porn, which I feel like some documentaries are. Mm-hmm. And I'm already vegan. I don't need to see all that.
Yeah, they presented the information very tastefully, even with the death of Don, the trainer. I remember that being very restrained in how they presented it.
Yeah, and it looks like by the time this episode comes out, SeaWorld will have had its last orca show. So it looks like its last show is actually supposed to be Sunday the 8th, I believe. There's another Veg News story that talks about how SeaWorld will hold its last orca show on Sunday, and the date leads me to believe that would be the 8th, which is before this episode will be coming out. So it looks like the orca shows are over. Unfortunately, Tilikum didn't ever get
freedom.
Yeah, freedom from the shows. So very sad news. We know it was all over the social media and people are very sad.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've seen so many people posting about it and saying, oh, Tilikum is finally free. And I get that mentality, but at the same time, I'm like, Tilikum was never free except for the 2 years before he was actually captured. You know, he didn't die and become free. Like, he died a captive.
I also think that's like a weirdly human concept to tag onto an animal that has no, you know, that's not how they're going to see it.
Right. Well, and also as, you know, non-believers, it's kind of a weird thing to hear, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like almost like saying, oh, Tilikum's finally free, and it feels like there's some semblance of justice is attached to that. But to me, it just seems incredibly unjust that he died still in captivity at SeaWorld.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree.
You know, even the idea that even if they had been able to release him, and I don't think that even would have been possible. I mean, once an animal's been held captive that long, a lot of times they can't just, like, put them back in the wild. So even that whole idea, like, that's not really freedom either. It leads you to believe that there's, Andy, like you said, like, some sort of justice or some sort of, like, making things right. And it's like this being, like, had its life stolen, and it doesn't really matter.
Well, and
how much, like, time they would have had, like, after, like, it's just, it doesn't really make anything right.
Yeah, because I think about that with people, right? Like, people who get sent to prison, and then it turns out that they were innocent, but they've been in prison for 20 years. You know, people who get sent away when they're children, like, you know, 18 or something. Like, they can't, it's not like they just get released and then they have this normal life.
Right.
They don't. Yeah. They've been institutionalized their entire lives. So even after they get out, they're never the same. They never have the life that they would have had. And I feel like it's that same like naive outlook that we use with animals a lot, where we say, you know, free the whales, open the cages. And it's like, yeah, of course we want them to be free, but you can't just overlook the fact that they've lived in captivity almost their entire lives. You can't just, they're not just going to swim away and then have this like normal, amazing life that they would have had.
Right.
So yeah. it does, I think it's a way to kind of minimize how bad we feel about mm-hmm. their situation and how difficult the actual solution is. And then I do feel like this, you know, rest in peace, you know, he's in a better place, or he's finally free now, is kind of part of that as well. Like, we don't want to really internalize and acknowledge that this beautiful creature had its entire life ruined and died in captivity, and that's his story.
Yeah, I was actually thinking along the lines of the exact same thing. And in addition, it also, like saying like, oh, he's finally free now, it makes it so that it makes us forget about the fact that we could have done something to prevent it like all along. And I think at least it makes us less likely to do something about like another animal mm-hmm. that's in a similar situation. It's kind of just saying like, oh, okay, like things are good now. Like mm-hmm. it was a terrible situation. Things are good now. It's like, we did the best we could. Things are good now. And I don't know. It just seems maybe a little bit like a, I don't know if a cop-out is the right phrase to use, but I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I'm looking to Andy for validation. He's
like, I have no opinion.
Please don't make it good.
I'm handing Paula cookie right now.
Well, why don't you give me cookie?
I know. Can you send us cookies in mail?
He can send you an HTML cookie, but
That was a good joke.
Thank you for that
Kelly's
validation.
Like, don't even think about it. I liked that joke.
Thank you.
I know you're a fan of jokes.
Yeah, no, and I was going to, Paul, you just made me think of another thing, which is that this also, it's kind of like, what's the message here? So, because to bring it back to PETA, we know PETA likes to kill animals because they think they shouldn't be owned. So instead of being a pet, they think they're better off dead. And is that almost feels like the message here as well. Like, if you can't, you know what I mean? Like, the solution to animal captivity is for them to just die. And then that absolves us of our guilt. And then they're, quote unquote, finally free. And then we don't have to worry about where to put them or what to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed.
Well, on that happy note.
It's like, bum, bum, bum.
So before we get into the main event, I wanted to talk about one other little thing that's got me on 10.
Yes.
Identity politics. I keep seeing this fucking phrase like everywhere, and it is really, really frustrating me. It's becoming like a buzz phrase, and I don't know. I used to hear it a little bit before. Maybe it's that I'm more aware now. I follow politics more closely than I used to, but it seems like this past year, and especially since the election, I keep hearing like political commentators and people that are trying to talk about politics and the election the way it went, they're blaming quote unquote identity politics, which, if you don't know, the idea is basically that if you're anyone besides a straight, white, privileged male, any political beliefs that you have that align with your identity, that are because of your identity, are now being labeled identity politics. And people, from my perspective, are basically being shamed for talking about politics in a way that brings their experiences, brings their needs as a non-white, male-presenting person into it.
That is so infuriating.
Yeah.
Because basically what that's saying, it's going back to that, you know, a white, middle-class, straight male is the default.
Yes.
And then anything else is extraneous and distracting and frustrating and besides the point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same. It almost reminds me of the way the people talk about, like, the 1950s as kind of this, like, wonderful time that we should get back to because things were like simpler and less complicated, right? Well, it only was that way for one group of people. And it was only because culture really only focused on one perspective, right? So it was, yeah, maybe things were a lot less complicated in politics, and I don't even believe that they were, but you only had basically like middle class white males like having the conversation. Everybody else was kind of ignored and their needs weren't being talked about. So now if you're a woman or if you're a person of color or if you're in the LGBTQ community, the fact that you now have a voice and can talk about the fact that you're going to vote based on what politicians say about issues that affect your life, they're making those people out to be overly emotional, that they're overreacting, that they're the ones that have made politics so contentious. Because people keep talking about how this election was so different than normal, that tensions were so much higher, that people were so upset, that we've never had such a contentious election in our like recent history. And people are like, oh, well, it's because of identity politics. Well, when has politics ever not been about someone's real life? Who gets elected and the policies that they put into place affect people's actual day-to-day lives?
Well, and is it also, P.S., is it identity politics when, you know, Christian people are voting about abortion or gay marriage?
No, Nicole, no. You're a little confused.
Okay. It must be all my woman hormones getting in the way it of is, my see? Understanding.
You need to calm down and think more like a man.
I do. Or just not be allowed to vote. I mean, that would just make things a lot simpler.
That would simplify things for sure. So have you two noticed this rise in this phrase as well? What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, you know, I've seen friends that were sort of really big into what would be classified as identity politics, and then they kind of move towards like just straight up being anti-capitalist, and they kind of go into that like, well, if we just fix capitalism, then all these other things will fall in line. So that was the first time that I ever started to see people using that phrase negatively. And then since the election happened, I've seen so many think pieces coming out just blaming it on identity politics or the like the quote unquote PC culture. And if people weren't so uptight about their pronouns, they could connect with their fellow Trump voters and you know, be able to get something done, and then we wouldn't have this divide. And I think it was Sean King that wrote a great piece on this and how it's not true that, you know, this is something that gets blamed every time something like this happens, to kind of shift blame onto those that are working towards making progress versus those that are impeding progress. In this case, people that are voting for Trump. And yeah, it's, I hadn't really even thought about it in terms of that specific phrase until you brought it up just now. But it is something that I've seen an immense amount of in the last 2 months or so.
Yeah, yeah. And from on my part, like, they're not using that exact phrase, but a lot of my students in high school, like, just in this past year, are talking, or maybe the past year or two, are talking a lot more about like PC culture and gender identity and like those sorts of things. And a lot of times, unfortunately, it's like not in the best way. So I try to call them out on that. But yeah, no, it definitely seems like it's. There's been a rise in it, even in the youths.
Yeah. Which we're supposed to be thinking of as like every generation's getting less prejudiced than the next, but yeah. Seems like it's still just as prevalent in many regards.
I think the fact that people are talking about it in high school is maybe a good sign. Because it's not like, I didn't mean to make it seem like every single student is saying the things that I wish that they wouldn't be saying, but I think the fact that it's talked about is a step in the right direction.
It's true.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm just really worried about how pervasive that term is becoming. And I'm surprisingly hearing it from a lot of people, like women and people of color and people that term should be offensive to them. And they've like internalized something and they're now shouting down other people about identity politics. I don't think for the most part, like as a whole, like I'm sure there are some people like activists that are talking about it, but it just seems like all of a sudden there's been this very effective but silent campaign to convince people that identity politics are to blame. And the fact that we're so divided and that the election went the wrong way, it's because of people advocating for themselves. And it's just really frustrating, you know? And it also spreads the lie that politics has ever not been personal. Like, when has politics ever not been personal?
And why shouldn't it be?
I'm sorry, even like a change in the taxes affects your take-home pay at the end of the day. How is that not personal? And people look at economics as kind of like the unemotional bar, right? Mm-hmm. For how to like look at politics. Like everything else is just overly emotional and about people like who like issues. Don't matter. Yeah, but it's like, oh, but it's really economics and all these identity politics are getting in the way. Well, the money that I take home affects me. I don't know about you, but that's very personal.
Yeah.
It seems like it's just sort of another coded way of telling people that aren't in the straight, white, cisgender, able-bodied, privileged men category to sort of sit down and know your role, and you're just mucking things up for the small amount of progress that you would have potentially maybe perhaps gotten from Hillary Clinton's presidency. Now you messed that all up because you spoke out of turn and you advocated for yourself.
Yeah. Oh, you asked for too much, so now you get nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, way to go. You wanted to have, you know. Ugh, it's just so, so incredibly annoying. I wanted to talk about it on, you know, in general, just because I think tying it into the fact that we're going to talk about, like, politics and the upcoming climate later, but just try to get this idea out. Like, everybody, if you hear this phrase, if you're using this phrase, like, try to call it out and ask people. Like, someone started a thread in some group I'm in the other day and was like, do you think identity politics are to blame for Hillary not winning? And I was like, what does that even mean? What is identity politics?
Right.
Yeah.
What are you saying? And you're a woman saying this. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and it's hard because it's like Hillary winning has become the default thing that should have happened. So that's also really heavily restricting the conversation because people have now just boiled it down to Hillary and Trump. So we're losing, in a lot of spaces, not all spaces, but we're losing the larger conversation, which is more, why did we get these two shitty candidates? Why, you know, was Bernie, like, not given a fair shot? I mean, there's just so many other conversations we also need to be having. And so I feel like, Andy, I like what you said, that it's like coded language to get people back in line. And I feel like we're just being kind of corralled again into, like, this is the conversation you're going to have. And we're not going to talk about all these other things that are actually really almost more important in a way, mm-hmm. which is like, why, as the people, why aren't we allowed to have other options?
Yeah, it feels like that's something that we really lost with this election was mm-hmm. that, like, and I know you've talked about this on your show as well, but, you know, Clinton, not a perfect candidate by any stretch, but if Clinton was in, we would be having conversations about how to push forward better regulations for, like, clean air, like, whatever it might be. But now that Trump is in, all of those conversations that are slightly more progressive are kind of like, oh crap, now we got to figure out how not to deport Muslims from the country. And it just feels like we've been there's like a bait and switch that happened or something, and now all of a sudden we have to have these conversations that we shouldn't even have to be having at this point in our progression as a country.
I agree, and I think that's by design.
Absolutely.
I don't think that's a coincidence by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. Well, I think the media does have a huge, mainstream media does have a huge role in this, right? They start a phrase, like buzzword type phrase, like identity politics, and they just start repeating it and repeating it, and all these other people start saying it, and all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, identity politics.
Yeah. You know,
most people don't know what they're even saying.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned how people, like, it's not identity politics, it's like the economy. And I actually came across a really great article that I just so happened to pull a quote from, just because I felt like it might come into play with this conversation, and maybe it'll serve as a good transition to the whole Trump aspect of this, but maybe you saw it as well. But on Vox.com, they posted that there was a study done, and it said that racism and sexism predicted support for Trump much more than economic dissatisfaction. And so I'm just going to read this little quote here. It said, a new paper by three political scientists puts the blame back on the same factors people pointed to before the election, racism and sexism. And the research has a very telling chart to prove it, showing that voters' measures of sexism and racism correlated much more closely with support for Trump than economic dissatisfaction after controlling for factors like partisanship and political ideology. And then the article also notes that there's been several studies that have come to pretty much the same conclusion. And then the most interesting thing was that they did not find the same correlation for support for McCain or Romney. And so to me, it's like, well, this is identity politics. Like, it's not people pushing for progressive things, but it's like white folks like scared that they're losing, you know, they're no longer having the privilege as things progress. And all of a sudden they're like, well, this is my identity that I'm trying to protect. And so the identity politics is only labeled when it's, you know, as you already said, not straight white guys doing it. But this is like the exact same thing from straight white guys.
Yeah, because it's like trying to shame people for caring about what they care about. So yeah. When it's white, straight white people, they don't need to be.
Yeah, it's the default.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like women's right to vote all over again. Like, well, let's get it for white women and then we'll worry about everyone else. And that's what this feels like, too. It feels like, you know, privileged white people being like, well, like, we should have just tried, you know, we should have just gotten the person who would relatively take care of us, and then we can worry about the rest of you later. And that's, I just feel like it's like we're on a hamster wheel of white privilege. We can't seem to get out of it.
My God, yeah. That's an amazing quote.
Right?
A hamster wheel of white privilege.
That's a t-shirt idea. Yeah,
and I don't feel any healthier with all.
No. Same. But yeah, it just feels like the same thing over and over again, where the mainstream basically is telling everyone else to take a seat mm-hmm. and be grateful that it's not as bad as it could be. And now we're in this situation where everyone's worst fears came true. And now we're just pointing fingers instead of creating these phrases like identity politics. It's designed to get, you know, marginalized people back in line. Mm-hmm. To be like, see, you did this by being selfish and trying to make it about you. You did this. And it's like, but isn't that literally what you're doing all the time for like the entire span of history?
Yeah. So I guess the question then is, how do we back out of this hole that we're in? Mm. Like, is there a way to correct course with this term and with this placing of blame?
Well, I personally think that what we have to do is, when we see that term, we, you know, try to call that person in that's using it, if it's someone that we have that type of relationship with, and have a discussion about what that phrase really means. And I think that the biggest thing that we can do, there's a tendency when you lose ground to try to renegotiate your ask, right? That you start... You go, oh, we asked for too much and we lost, so now we need to, like Nicole said, kind of like the suffragettes did, like, oh, we're only going to ask for this thing. The rest will come later. We need to see that for the lie that it is, and that it never works. There's never a later. Right. So we need to not adjust what we're asking for. We need to really ally ourselves with all other activists that are pushing for justice and doing anti-oppression work. And we need to stand firm that, like, right is right, and we're not going to start to turn on each other and throw each other under the bus and say, like, okay, you can ask for what you need for now, but you need to wait, and you need to be less aggressive in your message and all of that. Like, that's never going to work. If we let ourselves continue to be divided, we're never going to make any real progress.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, it's like when there were two like when there was an independent, what was it, in 2000? How they always talk about now how a third party candidate like ruins elections, mm-hmm. right? And they kind of use that as an example that like replicates every time. Like, oh, well, don't push for change because you could ruin it. It's like, no, we need to get away from that. We need to actually like push for what we want. And yes, Trump is a huge, huge setback. I mean, it cannot be understated what a setback he is. But that shouldn't change our ask. It shouldn't make us renegotiate what is actually just and what is actually right.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. And I would say, you know, as much as we can to understand what actually happened, to do some research. I mean, something I've been working on, I used to be pretty politically uninvolved, and now I try to really understand things and, you know, read a lot, keep up on everything. And so when someone says something like, well, you know, that's, you got Trump, like that's what you get for, you know, pushing your own agenda or whatever, just like understand what actually happened and the complex things that, you know, contribute to an election, and be able to have that conversation and call people out too and be like, so you're actually saying that I shouldn't care about my own rights? Like, is that actually what you're saying to me right now? You know, because I think sometimes people just regurgitate stuff. They see headlines, they watch Fox News or wherever they get their information, but it's really easy for someone to read one article that makes them feel comfortable and then to just kind of parrot back stuff they've read in that article without actually really doing an analysis or critically thinking about it. So push back if you're comfortable and say, like, do you hear what you're saying? Like, you're actually saying, you know, trans people shouldn't push for being safe in public restrooms? Like, are you actually saying women shouldn't, you know, care about whatever the situation is? But, like, are you really saying that? And see, just try to challenge their worldview a little bit and get them thinking outside of, you know, that one article that they read 3 months ago that they've been using as their, like, platform for everything.
Or even just read the headline.
Exactly.
They're, like, regurgitating the headline. So I think this conversation translates really well into what we wanted to talk about today, which is basically, like, how to be a vegan activist, like, in this new era where it seems like we're just putting out dumpster fires, like, everywhere. Right?
Trumpster fires. Trumpster fires.
New hashtag.
Yeah, that is absolutely a hashtag. So I've been very conflicted about, I almost feel like I've been neglecting my veganism since the election, and even I guess before that, like the months leading up to the election. Not that I've not been a vegan, obviously, but that I don't spend much time talking about like animal rights anymore, because it seems like there are so many other huge pressing issues, especially since, you know, the Orange Menace got elected, and now there is such a pressing emergency need in other communities that they need help. So it's, I don't know, it's almost felt really hard and selfish, maybe, in a way, although I don't think that's quite the right word, to talk about like farm animals, which are still are obviously very important. What's happening to them is an atrocity, and I'm not minimizing what they are having to go through, but yeah, losing this much ground, it's been kind of difficult. So we thought it would be really great to have the four of us talk, because we both have vegan podcasts. So vegan is kind of a huge part of our brands and identities and what we talk about. And how do we continue to do that with everything else that's going on?
Yeah, have you guys felt that way? Have you felt weird talking about vegan things, or have you felt okay with it? I know I've seen a lot of vegans promoting, you know, go vegan as a way to fight Trump.
Yeah.
And I'll admit, like, it does make me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And when I break it down, I'm like, well, I mean, it is like it is a political stance. It is a way to fight back against the establishment, but like, it just doesn't sit well right now, and I'm having a very hard time really being a vegan activist in this moment. So we were curious as to, you know, how you guys felt and what you're doing about it.
Yeah, I think we've both definitely felt that conflict. It was kind of weird for us because of our recording schedule. We had like two episodes come out from the time that Trump was elected to when we actually recorded a new episode, and it felt like really weird to just to be dropping episodes that like weren't acknowledging it. And then, and like even for my business, you know, I was like running this like Instagram contest and in the middle of it all, and I just wasn't, you know, I wasn't even thinking about that, you know, showing my privilege, of course, but it happened and I was like, how can I keep like pushing my business? How can I sell a t-shirt when all this horrible stuff is going on? And it's something that I have felt that exact same conflict of like, how do we continue to advocate for the rights of animals while at the same time this horrible thing is happening that is putting stuff that, you know, sadly has been like, you know, of great importance to us. I know all of us talk about all these issues on our podcast, but something about the Trump presidency just like really put it right in front of us. And maybe that's because we have friends that are now in danger of actually getting deported, or we have friends that have been victims of hate crimes or whatever it might be. But there's something about it that does seem more urgent. And maybe it's just because animals are often this like very abstract concept. Oh, there's this many billion animals that are dying, but we don't see them, and we can't really tell if we're having an effect until a report comes out and says this many less animals were killed. And so it's a lot harder to feel like that's the most urgent thing when we have our Facebook feeds filled with people that are terrified for their lives.
Yeah,
I think that, well, I'm gonna throw out an opinion here for the answer to the question. I don't think we necessarily need to like stop advocating for animals, but I think what this might mean is that we take maybe a little bit or some of the energy that we spent previously advocating for animals and putting it towards other issues as well. But I don't necessarily think it means kind of stopping whatever our animal advocacy is. I might just mean stepping up in other areas where we weren't necessarily before, and then also being mindful of how we're advocating towards animals, because there's definitely ways that we've seen animal advocates trying to push that issue, this issue, using Trump as just like a prop rather than also addressing some of these other terrible things that are going on. So I think in addition, we should just be more mindful of how we're advocating for animals, and if that's possibly going to, and not even if it's necessarily mentioning Trump, but just like this PETA thing that we were talking about, like being more mindful of how we're advocating towards animals and being like, oh, maybe I'm contributing to this problem that's now so in the, like Andy was just saying, it's like, it's always been there, but now it's like up front, it's, people are talking about it. Just thinking about like, oh, am I contributing to this too? Like, even if you don't, you know, if it's not your intention necessarily, I'm sure there's tons of people at PETA that don't even necessarily, that have to do with like making those ads and stuff, that just don't think that they are contributing to a problem, because all they're kind of focused on is like, oh, well, this is going to be good for animals. Like, they're not necessarily thinking that it's going to be harmful in other areas, but they're not thinking that it's not going to be harmful in other areas.
So we gotta, it's like up to us to make sure that people are thinking about it, I guess.
Yeah.
I really love that point. I think a great thing that we can do is, I know there's a lot of, obviously our shows both try to be very intersectional in the things that we talk about and the way that we advocate for animals. I almost feel like there needs to be kind of like a no tolerance policy in the vegan community, and that we need to start being, like to your point, Paul, like we need to start being louder about people trying to advocate for animals in very like oppressive ways for other communities, because the problems are now even more dire. And I'm not minimizing how bad they were before, but I think things will be worse under Trump. Obviously, a lot of people are afraid for their lives in a lot of different ways. And as a community, we just cannot be replicating oppression in our activism. Like, we need to really try to crack down on the sexism and racism and, you know, transphobia and homophobia, like all those things. Like, there just needs to be like, this is not acceptable. Like, it's okay if you want to focus on advocating for animals and not get involved in other movements, but you cannot use this space to mm-hmm. be shitty to all these other groups of people that are like terrified right now, and understandably so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned that the article that was like, go vegan to fight Trump kind of thing. And that just, like, it reminds me of views that are sort of espoused by our favorite guy, Gary Yourofsky, that's like, you know, veganism gets at the core of everything. And if you just go vegan, you won't be racist, you won't be sexist. We are all one. And if you just go vegan, that fixes everything. And it feels like people are doing that same thing. They're like, oh, this is an opportunistic moment. Oh, if you don't like Trump, you should go vegan. And it's like, people should go vegan because it's the right thing to do, not necessarily because they're trying to get at Trump somehow. But I'm wondering if you two have seen any other, I have a couple that come to mind, I guess, but like, have you seen any other ways that like vegan advocates, organizations or individuals have like gone, approached the Trump presidency in a really problematic way that you've seen?
Well, there was this one case where we contacted someone. We were notified by someone else, and I'm not going to use any names here because I don't want to use this as a way to like call people out and be shitty, but someone let us know that there is kind of a leader in the vegan movement, someone who's very well known, that had a very problematic post after the Trump presidency that was basically talking about, don't be upset, don't be sad. This is an exciting thing to happen because people are now going to be engaged and re-energized, and people are going to be fighting for justice because Trump won. That it's basically like waking people up. So this is an exciting time, not a sad time. And this was like right after the election. I mean, people were still, I was still in like my crying phase. Like, I would just have like random bouts of like bursting into tears. And I'm someone who's like relatively safe, you know, in this new era. So we contacted this person and wrote them a letter and tried to explain why maybe their messaging was poor timing and insensitive, and we never got a response. But I do think there is some of that, that not only were people advocating for veganism as a way to like stick it to Trump or whatever, like you were just saying, Andy, but that also people were talking about his election in an exciting way because like now people are finally going to be awake and they're going to be angry and they're going to be, you know, more people are going to be turning to activism than they would have before, which I think, to be honest, is probably true. I do think people right. are going to be more active and socially aware than they were before, but I don't think it's appropriate to talk about that in such a inappropriately cheerful way. Yeah. And especially right after it happened, like people were like grieving, and this person was like, it's okay, this is awesome. And it's like, yeah. no.
And there are just lines in the newsletter that were like, oh, I'm not afraid, I'm, you know, I forget what they said. It was like, I'm not afraid, I'm hopeful, or I'm full of something. And it was just very tone deaf.
Yeah.
And the thing was that it sounds very bad, but I think the overall message actually wasn't that bad. It was just a matter of framing. Mm-hmm. Like, this person was mostly addressing privileged white people who, as they put it, you know, donate to organizations and then go get their lattes and drive their Priuses and don't really do anything beyond that. And I think if the message had been directed, like, had opened up with like, hey, privileged white liberals, guess what? Now is the time to do some shit, and maybe hadn't focused so heavily on veganism specifically, I think it actually could have been a really cool message, but it just wasn't framed that way, and it wasn't clear who it was addressing. So, you know, a person of color or an LGBTQ person or even a woman, as myself, reading it is kind of like, whoa, this is really tone deaf. and kind of offensive. When we know that wasn't the
right
purpose of it, but I think we're seeing that a lot with vegan celebrities, if you will, or, you know, people who are kind of the face of veganism, especially people who are kind of food related. I think that there are a lot of the messaging coming out is like, hey, don't be sad. Like, this is a time when we can all make change. And it's just very tone deaf, if nothing else.
Yeah.
What have you guys seen?
I've definitely seen things of that nature that sort of just really underplays the impact that the election has had or is going to have. And just really just kind of minimizing the very real, like, absolute terror that a lot of people are feeling over the thing. Mm-hmm. And something that's, I guess, maybe not as bad, but, like, just, like, one notch below it is organizations that just haven't acknowledged it at all. You know, seeing, mm-hmm. like, major organizations the day of the election announcement just sending out fundraising asks and things like that. And it's like, I'm sure they had this, you know, plugged into their Hootsuite, you know, 2 weeks ago, but at the same time, it's just like realize something has happened and like put the brakes on it. Like, wait a couple of days at the very least before you sort of just go back to business as usual, because this whole thing is not business as usual. And it just makes it feel like the organization is super out of touch or doesn't care about their, you know, the people that are supposed to be members of their organization. I think that's probably been the biggest one, is just a lack of acknowledgement from so many people.
I think that's a great point, because I know after the election, I know I did, and I'm sure Callie did. We didn't really talk about it, but I was very careful with everything we posted to social media. And I kind of, you know, I held back on posting a lot of things, and a lot of stuff that I posted was framed around acknowledging that this was a stressful time and that these things were happening. And I agree. I think probably a lot of places it was just an oversight and things maybe be pre-scheduled, but there did seem to be a lack of awareness around, oh, like, we just got to keep up our usual social media posting and promote this thing. And it's like, no, you kind of need to not do that right now, or at least have some awareness. And I think it's relevant, right, because we have Inauguration Day coming up, and then I'm sure there's going to be some terrifying bills that are passed or whatever. So I just think that this is good general guidance going forward, is to kind of be plugged in and make sure that you're not scheduling something really, like, capitalist or just, you know, something that's kind of silly around things that are happening in the news.
Yeah. Well, and I just like the idea in general of, like, you know, the expression, like, reading the room.
Yeah.
Like, try to understand the community that follows you and understand when something may be impacting them. Like, it's a silly example, but even, like, the day after the election, or, you know, even a couple of days after, like, seeing vegans being like, look at this, like, thing that I made, like, posting, you know, or like, oh, like, have you guys tried this new restaurant? Like, the morning after the election, I want to be like, fuck you. Like, like, I know that people's lives didn't necessarily, like, go on hold, and I know that, as shocking as it is to me, not all vegans, like, voted the same. I'm sure some people weren't upset after the election. For those people, I say, like, you know, get it together. But it just seemed like the fact that some people were just like, oh, like, things are great. Like, look at this, like, smoothie I made. It's like, are you serious?
Look at this smoothie that's spilling over the jar because it's so overfilled.
It's so messy. I hate that.
Yeah, the mason jar smoothie.
It's so pristinely messy. Doesn't it just make you
hate, like, your life? Artfully melted.
Yes.
Yeah, it was kind of like, okay, like, get it together. Like, don't, you know. And, yeah, like, these social media accounts that were posting, like, recipes or just, yeah, fundraising drives or things that they had going on that didn't really have anything to do without any sort of acknowledgement about what was going on seemed just really in poor taste.
Yeah, I'm thinking now, I'm just remembering that there was a couple of victories that many people would consider animal rights victories, like Prop 3 in Massachusetts with like the cage-free eggs and gestation crates and whatnot. And a lot of people were sort of gleefully celebrating that, which I get, and it's like nice to celebrate something given the dark times, but again, without being coupled with that acknowledgement of like, you know, even if you're just like, hey, everything is horrible right now, there's this small glimmer of hope right here. You know, something, even a small acknowledgement like that would make it not as bad. But when all people are doing the day of the election is just celebrating this thing, it just seemed, again, people were not reading the room. They weren't taking the temperature. And it just is like, okay, so I guess all these other things don't matter to you. Like, what's going on right now?
I think I saw some people doing the thing like, where it's like, hey, everything is shit right now, but hey, at least this, we got this.
Yeah. I'm sure many people did approach it appropriately.
Yeah.
But I also saw plenty of people that did not, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think about, I kind of have this idea of a way to continue to advocate for veganism. You'd have to be really careful about it, but I like the idea of presenting it as, going vegan is something that you can do to make you feel like you're making a difference. Like in this time where we have such a big fight ahead of us on so many fronts, it's really hard to feel like you're taking any action that has a noticeable impact, or that you feel like every day there's something that you can do. Whereas like going vegan, while it isn't going to change the system as a whole, it's not going to bring down capitalism or sexism or racism, but like having vegan meals is actually some way that you can feel like you did something today, something to be proud of, while still doing all the other work that you're doing.
I think in theory, that might be a good thing. But I worry that what that would possibly, I mean, not for everybody, but I think for some people, what that could turn into is like the kind of self-congratulatory type of animal advocate that just kind of, you know, goes out and yells at people and is like, I made a difference today because I yelled at this woman, this random woman on the street. And which like we've talked about many times as, you know, probably not being the best thing and not even being the best thing, but like putting aside all the other issues, not being the best thing for veganism. But I worry that like if you promote veganism as a way to feel good about yourself, then that would be like the, like a side effect of that would be that you would get more of those sorts of advocates that are just doing things without really thinking if they have any sort of positive effect for animals. It's more so of just like, oh, I'm doing this because it feels good for me, you know?
I think, I mean, one, we could always include a caveat of don't go yell at people when you're vegan. Right.
I feel like that's always rule number one.
but also, I guess my worry would be people thinking that it's enough. So I think as long as it's sort of accompanied with a message of, hey, while you're fighting for all these other things, you can also feel like you've accomplished something tangible every day when you're consuming these vegan meals or, you know, living your vegan lifestyle, whatever it might be. Because I do totally get that mindset. And I certainly use that with a lot of people. And that's something that I kind of hold on to myself is like, there's so many huge issues. I can't stop a war. I can't do this. But this is something in my small way that I can hold myself accountable to my ethics, much in the same way that I can hold myself accountable to my ethics if I don't use certain languages or don't support certain companies or, you know, whatever it might be. So I think it can be a really helpful way of getting people on board. But I guess it's just how you present it, because you don't want to be like, hey, Trump is horrible, but at least you can go vegan, you know?
Yeah. And right.
Yeah. And I don't mean it that way at all. It would more be like, and I don't even mean advocating for veganism in the fact that you're going out there advocating for animals. I mean, like, for people that want to feel like they're able to do something, eating vegan food would be a way that they could feel like they're taking some sort of action every day. Not the only action necessarily that they're taking, but it may be a good way to talk to people who want to feel like they're doing things and maybe they're already an activist in other way. And obviously you don't want to like barge in another movement and be like, go vegan. You'll feel like you're making a difference by eating vegan food every day. But, you know, having this conversation, it's like, you know, a lot of us feel really powerless right now. And this might be a way to make you feel like in one small way, you're taking an action, you're doing something.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that idea. I like that idea. I think it would just have to be carefully implemented.
Yes.
So don't have an ad about how people who go vegan have better sex.
Exactly.
No. Oh my God.
No, maybe not that.
Yeah, I think now more than ever, it's really a matter of intersectional veganism, right? If we're going to call it that, inclusive veganism. I think like we were saying towards the beginning, we just can't accept people being privileged and blind to other people's issues within this movement. We need this movement to include concerns about everybody, to include, you know, I mean, the more I learn, the more I'm flabbergasted that I ever was introduced to this, you know, issues with the food system and never heard anything about the people who suffer from it. You know, you watch Food Inc. or something, and it gives you all this shocking information that gets you all fired up, but it doesn't talk about the workers in the factory farms or the reason that they're even there in the first place, you know? So we're able to have all these kind of vegan conversations and these conversations about our food system and never once give a shit about the people who drive, who make that food system even possible, you know, in a bad way because they're being exploited. So just, you know, I think if any of us are going to proceed, and obviously we've been doing this for a while now, but I think you have to educate yourself and you have to have your message be inclusive and aware of the issues that humans face, even as it relates to vegan issues.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, again, as we all keep harping on it, sort of, especially as white folks, it's our duty. And for me and Paul, especially as cis men, it's like super our duty to be making sure that those are the messages that get out there. Because, you know, we're often kind of, for better or worse, the gatekeepers of a lot of this information, you know, as content creators and, as people who are kind of visible within the vegan movement. And I think it's definitely our duty to sort of incorporate intersectional issues with everything that we're doing.
Yeah. What is there anything else, like any ideas that you guys have about how to continue being like a vegan advocate, a vegan activist, you know, advocate for animals like in this new world that we're entering?
I think so much of it is, as you've pointed out, reading the room and knowing your audience, which has always been relevant to how you promote any issue, I guess. But it's like super important now that you make sure you're not, you know, throwing something out there that's just totally flying in the face of the life experience of someone that you're talking to. I think that in terms of sort of not necessarily outwardly promoting veganism, but within our own movement, is making sure that people that are already on board with veganism are on board with all the other intersectional issues. And that, as we all know, has been a really hard challenge to kind of open people up to that. A lot of people, when you bring up those issues to a vegan, they react as if, you know, a meat eater is reacting to someone bringing up veganism, like just every denial, every possible excuse. I was listening to a really great interview with Sarah Woodcock on the AR Zone podcast, and she was just sort of talking about how this election is going to affect both, you know, women and people of color, but as well as just sort of the animal rights movement in general, in that it is now putting a lot of people in vulnerable communities under attack a lot more than normal, and they're going to have even less time to devote to fighting for animal rights because they're just fighting for their own lives. And so I think that, you know, we should be talking to other white folks about caring about, you know, racism, because racism is bad in and of itself. But we can also say that, like, you know, if we're truly looking to create a vegan world, that means you know, getting rid of all these oppressions because that means everyone has more time to focus and work on the animal issues as well. Not like you have to put one in front of the other, like, oh, you got to work on this and then work on this. But I think that it's like important for us to realize that we're not going to have a vegan world if we're not working to undo like all these oppressions that are going on. And we know that everything is interconnected, but I feel like it's even more apparent how interconnected everything is with this presidency coming up and showing how, you know, how we are able to allocate our time. You know, doing activism is a privileged thing. It's privileged if you're able-bodied. It's privileged if you have time, if you don't have to work, you know, 80 hours a week to make ends meet, whatever it might be. And so we sort of have to recognize that and do the things we can to alleviate those pressures off of other people so that we can also fight for animals altogether.
Mm, I like that. That's a really good point.
You too.
Because I think there is going to be kind of a tug of war over the next few years over resources, right? Time, money is a big one. You know, maybe you were donating to animal advocacy groups and now you're going to be splitting that between Planned Parenthood or the ACLU or, you know, other groups that are funding really important work to try to stop what's going to be happening. So I think trying to be understanding of people's the ways that people are going to be pulled in a lot of different directions or that their focus is going to be pulled significantly because they are fighting for their lives or their families and very real consequences.
Yeah. And I would put a call out to any vegan who has the platform right now to get educated and then use that platform to at least acknowledge that these other things exist, you know, maybe get a little political. I know a lot of vegan celebrities avoid that, and that's why they stick with food because everyone loves food and it's safe. But, you know, put it out there, and even if it's something small, like, hey, there's a Black Lives Matter rally happening this weekend, like, go show up for it. Or, hey, consider donating to Planned Parenthood because this is going on right now. Just use your platform to not just talk about the easy vegan thing, but to start making your audience more aware of these other issues. You know, that's what happens with us, and I'm sure that must be what happened with you guys. People who listen to your show, they might come to it because they're vegan, and then they end up hearing us talk about these other things, and it expands their worldview, and all of a sudden now they're intersectional, and now they're, you know, more focused on the political climate as a whole. And I think more vegans need to give up that cushy food bubble and step out a little bit. It doesn't mean they have to be quite as political as we are, but do something. You know, talk about, say, hey, I saw some vegans using All Lives Matter. I saw Veg News used All Lives Matter. It's a problem, and here's why. Like, let me dedicate 5 or 10 minutes of my podcast, or let me put a blog post out there about why this is a problem and why, like, we need to, as a community, we need to stop. Because I feel like it's too easy for vegans who don't want to be aware to find these places to go hide where they're not confronted by any of this information.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I think that, I know we certainly do, and I would imagine you two do as well. With our podcast, we kind of hope to show people that they can have both. Like, I know you don't talk about food, but we'll talk about food and then we'll talk about this other issue. And you two both joke around, you have fun, but can still talk about serious things. And I feel like people have this, like, you either have to be super radical and that's the only thing you talk about all the time. And so hopefully we can help get people to realize you can still do your thing, and but you can inject this other stuff, and you're not going to lose your audience. People aren't going to stop caring about you. Maybe some people will leave you, but you don't need them if they leave you.
So yeah. True. I love the idea of people trying to use their platform because, you know, it does get a little frustrating, especially since they tend to attract way bigger audiences.
They do.
You know, an Instagram account that just posts pictures of artfully melted smoothies in mason jars will have way more followers than someone who's politically active. And it's like, that's great. I mean, no shade on that. Like, I know that is a way that people are connecting through food, and that's great. But, like, come on. Like, try to use a little bit of it. Use a little bit of that privilege that you have of the audience that you've gained by covering this one thing to try to educate people a little bit.
Post a picture of the comfort food you just made and say, I'm sad today and here's why. And like, this is something to be aware of. You know, there's ways to blend it into what you're already doing. And yeah, you're going to get people who are like, oh, this is so political. I just want to look at pictures of food. And you're like, well, that's very privileged. It's very privileged that you're able to just look at pictures of food and not think about these things. However, that's not the reality for a lot of other people, you know? And it takes some guts. Like, you have to stand, being political means that you have to be prepared that people are going to push back and not like it, and you're not going to be able to be this fluffy, well-accepted person anymore, but it's important. And I don't think that we can really keep pushing veganism and just ignore these other things anymore.
Yeah.
I think it's irresponsible to do so.
Damn. Yes.
I said it.
You did. You just laid it all out.
But didn't sound like you were at 10, though.
I've come down a little bit.
This was really good. This, like, a really great conversation.
And we're going to be doing next week, as part of kind of blending pretty much everything we talked about today, our topic next week is going to be about veganism as a political stance. We're going to kind of talk about the history of veganism and how being a vegan actually is and was intended to be a political statement. And I think that conversations like that are kind of a nice way to blend, you know, politics into veganism and just talk about how your veganism can be a stand to be anti-establishment without necessarily being like, veganism is a cure for everything.
Please never say that.
Please literally never say that.
And we mean literally as literally. We know that.
Not the new definition of literally. Right. The original definition.
The original definition of literally. As in never.
We have absolutely no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah, I was going to say, next week we'll probably figure out something to talk about the hour before we talk about it.
Sometimes we're there, too. Yeah.
Not going to lie, sometimes we're sitting over the microphone being like, well, what do we got?
Or we'll start talking and realize we totally didn't talk about what we said we were going to talk about. It went off in like a totally different direction, so we have to like re-record our intro so that the title of the episode matches what we ended up saying.
Oh, that's so clever. We would probably just re-record the whole conversation.
Oh my god.
Or make it two different episodes.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, yeah. Sometimes there's that, especially if it gets really long. All right. Well, it was really a pleasure talking to you both, as always. Have a really great day, you guys.
Thank you.
Yes, you as well.
So we hope you enjoyed our second annual crossover episode. Is it annual? Is there an official?
The last one came out around the same time.
Okay. Then we hope you enjoyed our second annual crossover episode with Vegan Warrior Princess Attack podcast.
Mouthful.
It is.
I had a blast. I don't know. They're great. They're wonderful people, and we always have a lot of fun talking with them, and it's cool to do these crossover episodes.
Yeah. Hey, you out there. You got a vegan podcast? You got a not vegan podcast? Let's do a crossover episode.
We actually mean that.
I'm trying to think of like a real outlandish crossover.
The Joe Rogan experience or whatever.
So yeah, as always, you know, we want to know what you think. Send us an email, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. Head over to our Instagram page or our Facebook page, relatively new, just The Bearded Vegans. And very new, our website, TheBeardedVegans.com.
What an original website name. Really throwing a curveball at everyone there.
I was really hoping for like TheBearded.Vegans or Vegans.Beards, but unfortunately those do not exist.
Just Beardos.com. Beardos.com. Beardo Central.
Don't worry. Don't worry. Beardos.com will come eventually when one of our diehard fans, our fan club, creates a fan page.
It's going to be your dad.
It's going to be both our dads.
The Bearded Dad Club.
So yeah, we had a lot of fun doing that episode. Let us know what you think. I think that's all that I had to say. So, Andy, what do you got coming up?
Well, I will be peddling my Compassion Company wares, t-shirts, hoodies, tank tops, scarves, all that good stuff. January 22nd at the Vegan Market in Brooklyn, New York. January 29th at the Vegan Pop-Up in Morristown, New Jersey. And then February 4th, Paul.
Yes, Andy.
Very special opportunity in my life.
Yeah.
I am going to be a judge at the Philly Chili competition, all vegan chili competition, and I get to judge food.
I feel like this is what you were born for.
If it goes well, I might just leave you, Paul.
And I think in the last episode, I said I was going to be there. Not exactly sure if I'm going to be there. I will most likely be there at least for the ending of it, because I think it's going to about 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
But so hopefully you'll see me walking around.
Yes.
Aimlessly, confused.
He'll have the red beard.
Yes. I'll be the one with the red beard.
And then February 25th, Paul, I'm leaving you.
No.
For real. I'm driving across the country. No. I'll be doing the PHX Vegan Food Festival in Phoenix, Arizona. And then March 26th, I'll be at the Vegan Street Fair in Los Angeles. I'm excited for that. That means, Paul, we finally are going to be talking about food that's not in Philly or New York once again.
Or Boston.
I'm sure people that are new to the podcast are like, oh, they live in Philly and New York because that's all the food they talk about. Couldn't be further from the truth.
Wrong. Andy lives nowhere. Anything else, Andy?
I think that's it. I think all the remaining podcast duties fall on your shoulders right now.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off.
Forgive the kids, for they don't know how to live. Run the alleys casually.
Thank you for inviting us to do this.
Yeah, thank you.
It's become our yearly tradition.
Yes.
I know. I like that. I like it. We're the two vegan podcast buddies.
Yeah.
Not the only two vegan podcasts, but no. We have a
the only two that matter.
Oh, what? Damn.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Sorry to Colleen Patrick Goudreau, who's listening right now, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure. She downloads every episode.
Hey, we're coming for that next year's Veg News Award. Yeah.
Watch your neck, CPG.
I was just kidding about that. I hope everyone that's listening to this realizes.
I'm actually going to put those words on your tombstone, Paul.
Yeah, don't walk that back. Be bold. It's okay.
That's how we're going to start every episode now.
Welcome to the only podcast that matters.
Pew, pew, pew.
Oh, God, the only podcast that matters on WHUS.
Oh my God.
That's my dream.
Yeah.
Callie's dreading the day when I get a soundboard.
I can't wait.
Like hardcore dreading that.
Everything will be that boing. Boing.
That's when you're talking about PETA.
We got to get PETA out of here. Boing, 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 boing.
Yes. I love it.
Gone off the rails.
Yeah.
Yes, as always. Well, have a really great day, you guys.